This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Stuff we're here to talk about in this episode include...
Table Sense.
Zhongli Chun.
Shakespeare, Johnson, or Marlowe.
And Morton the Regent's Murders.
Well, I sure am glad President Cat greenlit the Catstronauts' mission to expand the International Space Station. I hear he signed the authorization by swatting a pen across the floor. True leadership right there.
Giant laser pointers in space? What's not to like? And even better, the space station has live stream cameras. Although, half the time it's just nose boops. Let's check how the Catstronauts are doing up there on the space station.
Oh man, there goes Waffles the pilot. He's off to see how many kibble bits can achieve orbit around his belly. A pioneer in snackodynamics, that cat.
Here comes the kitty technician, Blanket. Careful, Waffles. If he catches you clogging the air filters with crumbs again, then it's back to litter box duty for you.
Wait a second, Robin. Major Meowser just got a hair-raising transmission from HQ. Is that the new napping module on its way?
Yep, it's their first space station edition. Science Officer Pom Pom better know what to do, or there'll be a... catastrophe in 3, 2, 1.
Here she is, and she's sharpening her claws on the instruction manual. Well, it might accidentally flip to the right page with enough swiping, I guess.
Look at them working together. Waffles is keeping the station steady with his prodigious belly. Blanket is swatting at the module's fasteners like a feather toy. Pom Pom finally found the right instructions, and Major Meowser is, napping on them? Teamwork, by golly!
Hooray for the Catstronauts!
The space station is saved!
Until the next module arrives and starts another near-catastrophe, that is.
Wow, managing your own space station with a crew of feline heroes. Now that's the life!
You know you can, Robin. The official Catstronauts board game is available now from Atlas Games. It's full of pawsome color art by the comic book's creator, Drew Brockington, and Catstronauts features cooperative play that's fun for all ages. Find out more at atlas-games.com/catstronauts.
Sounds like the Catstronauts board game is perfect for the whole family. Let's meet this stellar challenge by picking up the Catstronauts board game now!
The rattle of dice, the thump of miniatures, the crunch of Doritos, and the benevolent gaze of Peter Frampton coming alive welcome us once more to the Gaming Hut. And today, what we're going to do is we're going to think about the table. Not the table in the Gaming Hut, which might be the old dining room table that got scuffed up. It might be Dad's billiard table that's down here. It might be just a ping pong table or some card tables that Mom's let us put together. But no, we're thinking about the table in a metaphorical sense. Our sense of the table, of what happens at the table, and why you, as an RPG scenario designer especially, should have table sense. And Robin, I'm assuming that we're not going to be going on a disquisition of angles of incident and leather versus hardwood as a surface to roll dice on, but instead you have a more metaphysical concept in mind, so share it.
Yes. The table sense is a term I've taken to using for what is going to happen at the table, which is an important question to ask yourself when you're writing a scenario, particularly a scenario based on any of the archetypal scenario types that I've identified previously, except kind of for the dungeon. You know what's going to happen at the table there as people are kicking down doors and fighting the creatures inside. But for anything with kind of a plot that you need to provide options for and be aware of what the players are going to do when you present them with those options, you need to have a sense of what's going to happen when your scenario hits the table. And surprisingly often, because it is convenient to kind of forget what players are going to do, or perhaps you have, you know, very compliant players who do not disturb your in-house playtest with doing things that they sense you don't want them to do, you have to account for that because you might have to write several paragraphs or even a scene accounting for what will happen when the players do X. Some of these are just sort of negative things that you shouldn't do, you shouldn't try to get away with because they're not going to work. The whole thing's going to fall apart at the table. The most classic example of that we've talked about before is where the scenario says, And then the bad guy gets away. And the answer to that is, do they? Because I'm looking at this character sheet and there's all sorts of ways that the player characters can stop a bad guy from getting away. There's, in trad games in particular, there's copious rules allowing them to do that. They've got skills and feats and maybe magic. So you can't write your scenario with the convenient idea that the bad guys get away so that they don't provide you with, you know, information that short circuits the plot, or they don't get to come back later for the big climactic fight. Well, the players are going to try to catch the bad guys, and they are going to, quite rightly, right? This is not an example of the players being oppositionally defiant. This is the contract that the game gives them, says that you get to chase the bad guys. They're going to chase the bad guys. So remember, that's going to happen. And instead of trying to railroad them by taking away all of their ability to catch the bad guys, you've got to write your scenario so they might catch the bad guys.
Yeah, the question of, you know, what if we just burn down the haunted house always has to be in the forefront of the game designer's mind, because this, again, is a contract. We are stopping a haunting. We're burning down the haunted house. That seems like a perfectly sound way to do it, especially if no one's in it, right? It's just an old wreck. Our uncle left it to us.
Right.
We own this haunted house.
In a previous episode, we talked about a number of places at Cambridge that were taken out of commission in order to get rid of ghosts. So that's an option. It might even be in the ghost playbook.
Right. The notion that you expect the players to operate like characters in a story is, I think, the sort of the thing that is at the root of bad table sense when you're writing a scenario. You forget the interactive half of game design. And another thing besides we burn the haunted house down,
let me just interject.
Yeah.
What if they set it on fire?
Yeah.
Is a table sense question that you must ask yourself far beyond the remit of mere haunted houses.
Yes, this
is true. Any house where the bad guys are or their headquarters, you have to be aware of the fact that they may just decide to demolish the building and figure out what interesting thing happens if they try and fail, and what interesting thing happens that keeps the story going if they try and succeed.
The old, well, there's no way to break into this guy's house. Is there a way to break into a semi-trailer? Because now I figured out a way to break into this guy's house.
Yeah. And break-ins are another example. If you have table sense should tell you that if the players find out that there's a villainous or even sort of slightly questionable character who might have information for them, they're going to say, instead of talking to him, which is annoying because we hate talking to people, can we sneak in later and burgle his place? So table sense should tell you to create a scene of what happens if they burgle the place. That could be a super fun scene. You got to remember to write it.
Yeah, exactly. It has to be there. Also, allied to is the what if we give up on this stupid story to begin with? Again, that goes back to the, you know, earliest F20 games when, oh, nope, we are third level and we are on the seventh level of this dungeon. We should get out of here. That is absolutely normal, absolutely respectable. And in a F20 game, maybe that makes sense. But in a game of occult or vampiric or regular investigation, that derails story. You have to figure out a way to logically keep them in the story as opposed to noping out. And that can be a constraint set up in the scenario or a constraint set up by the rules with like gumshoes drives or something else.
And that's one where table sense goes both ways, because you also have to account for the scene that you're writing where you assume that they know to run away from the vampire and they don't. And you have to figure out what happened. It's like, this will end the story rather abruptly if they ignore every single possible flag telling them not to attack the vampire. And what if they still do? And part of the answer is often make the flags redder.
Yeah.
Because,
and bigger.
Right. Because
and more of them.
Right. Because when you're GMing that situation, you have to like clock, do the players think that this is set up for them to win a fight, or are they willing to lose a fight? And those are two very different things. But again, for a scenario writer, you've got to be aware of your assumption of what the players will do. Often they will choose to be more aggressive than you think they will. And that happens more often, in fact, than people surprising you by noping out.
Yeah. So Robin, do you have the way to get table sense is to play a scenario over and over again, or to play a lot of scenarios over and over again, to have been at the table long enough to be able to think like a player. It helps if you have fiendishly clever players like I do, but even random players are often fiendish enough to wreck the scenario unless you plan for it. Is there some other sort of approach that you can offer in addition to, or instead of, run your scenario 90 times?
Well, I don't think you need to run your scenario 90 times yourself. That's not all that useful. You can just run 90 scenarios.
One time.
Yeah. If you're a younger designer, put in your time, right? And you can't really play role-playing games if you don't run role-playing games. Also, if you're an older designer, but you haven't run a game in 10 years, your table sense is going to atrophy. So that's going to be apparent on the page. And also having a group of very compliant cooperative players who look to you for cues and figure out what you want them to do and do it, you are depriving yourself of table sense by having such a lovely group of accommodating players, because they don't do the weird ass things. So the only shortcut to that is one that is not widely available to most people, which is you become when you send your scenarios out for professional publication, as either a designer or as I'm currently doing as creative director for Pelgrain, as someone that's seeing playtest feedback on other people's adventures, you can have the benefit of seeing what happens at other people's tables in the form of playtest reports. So, for example, a question of table sense that I have not run into in person, but now know to look for because of seeing it come up repeatedly in different playtest reports, is if the scenario reaches a point where it's not immediately evident what trail the players are supposed to follow, especially in an investigative game, they will report back to headquarters for more instructions.
Yeah.
And that is usually something you don't want them to do. I hadn't run in that in person, but I now know, looking at playtest reports, that that is another issue, and that in an investigative game, there always has to be at least one lead to follow. You can't have a pause where they just wait around and then someone comes to them with a clue. That's sloppy in a couple of ways.
Yeah.
But you've always got to have a thread for them to follow.
Yeah, another option that you can do is, once you've written the scenario, run it solo for yourself. And run it not as the person who is cooperating with you, but as the person you would be if you were playing it at the table run by somebody else.
Right, because GMs are notorious backseat drivers.
So, exactly.
You may be the exemplar of the... And I want to stress again, this is not about avoiding bad players intentionally subverting the scenario. This is about knowing how very smart players will use the tools that they have been given to do the things that they expect to be able to do.
Or how the wisdom/madness of crowds will take even five completely normal players and turn them into a diamond drill aimed exactly at the thing you don't want them to do. So
right.
You need to have, you know, all the joints of your scenario need to be drill proof, I guess is what we're saying.
Right. Now there's sort of an opposite phenomenon, which is you also sort of have to be ready for what if none of them do the absolute obvious thing that you've placed three flags in the turf for them to do. But I think that's another topic. And we all know that when we reach a topic switch, we switch completely into a completely different hut and or segment, which I think lies on the other side of this beautiful handcrafted commercial.
Moving drama.
Hilarious comedy.
And you are the sole protagonist.
Page Turners is my game of personal storytelling for one player and one GM.
Coming soon from Pelgrain Press.
Longtime listeners know Hillfolk, my game of dramatic group play.
Winner of the coveted Diana Jones Award.
Page Turners shifts its dynamic down to the intimate scale of a single main character whose fiction you weave on the fly with one other creator.
Shockingly simple rules keep the focus on emotional interaction.
Extensive guidance helps you shape satisfying outcomes.
Writers Sarah Sam Saltiel, Wade Rocket, and Ruth Tillman join Robin in presenting 11 scenarios spanning a wealth of genres and tones.
Scenarios include
Jazz Age Ambition and Glamour,
a childhood haunted by strife, And the shadowy being.
Deceit and survival on the spaceship Earth again.
A stay in Bath takes an unexpected turn in the Austin-inspired Entreaty and Entanglement.
The screwball 30s hijinks of Loose Screws.
The Shakespearean comedy of Love's Loyal Laborers.
A love triangle unfolding from the turbulent 60s to the troubled 20-teens.
Behind the music drama in the L.A. punk scene.
The arrival of a telepathic stranger on a space-bound way station.
Tragic love between a vampire and a mortal.
And an epic multi-generational saga of artificial beings attempting to build a civilization in the tradition of that extinct species, Homo sapiens.
Gorgeously laid out and illustrated by graphic superstar Jen McCleary.
Whoever you want to be, wherever your imagination takes you.
Whether your journey leads to Union Doom or something harder to define.
Page Turners unleashes your story in new and unexpected ways. The incense burning in front of the idol. The mysterious text uncovered in the desert. The lightning overhead when I say that it's an idol and a mysterious text instead of a scripture and an actual god welcome us into the Mythology Hut. And in this particular instance of Mythology Hut, we're going east, not west, for more of a legend, I think, than a myth. This sort of a...
Yes, well, it's a real person to whom mythological powers are attributed. So
yes,
this goes beyond Robin Hood to like a documented person,
right?
But unlike a lot of other documented people who we would cover in the History Hut, turns invisible. So got filed under Mythology Hut.
Exactly. And the specific person we're talking about is Zhong Li Chun, who is one of the four great ugly women of Chinese legend. And if you, like me, are curious, the other three are Mo Mu, who was the wife of the Yellow Emperor. She invented the mirror, which must have been a shock to her. And the Yellow Emperor, waste not, want not kind of attitude, would use her face to drive away evil spirits. And then Meng Huang, who is the virtuous wife of the moral philosopher Liang Hong, he avoided her because she was wearing finery for their wedding. And she said, avoiding me is not very moral. And he said, wearing finery is not very moral. And then she opened up her trousseau and realized she and showed him she'd only packed linen and rags. And he said, oh, you are the wisest. And so they were wise and virtuous together.
Right.
And then finally, the last of the ugly women is Ruan Shi, who was the wise wife of a minister of Wei state. And she just shamed him because he was supposed to be wise, which meant he was supposed to look past such superficialities as physical appearance. And when she pointed that out to him, he was thunderclapped and realized that she was as wise as he. And that was the basis of their happy marriage. So that is the story of the four great ugly women, all of whom married and useful members of their family. So good for them.
Yes. So she's born in 350 BC, maybe 370 BC in Wuyan village. And so this is, for context, this is during the Warring States period, the lengthy period in which many regional kingdoms are battling for survival and supremacy. And it's also a time of cultural ferment. Confucianism is being codified by follow-on scholars, and the elements of Taoism are beginning to arise and have yet to be codified. So this is a big dramatic period, a subject of many exciting films, and exactly the sort of time when a woman could rise to fame by being homely and turning invisible.
Right. And she is, her village Wuyan is in Qi, which is the kingdom that's now Shandong province. And I know what you're saying. You're saying, yes, 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 historical context. Yes, yes, yes. How ugly was she? And fortunately, her biographer Liu Zhang in 18 BC in Biographies of Exemplary Women has described her. He says, her head resembled a stone mill. Her eyes were deeply sunk. She had a large head, big joints, upturned nostrils, a prominent Adam's apple, a thick neck, sparse hair, a hunched back, and dark skin. Which does not sound very prepossessing in 18 BC, I'm sure. And unsurprisingly, she has reached the ripe age of 40, so no one has asked for her hand in marriage, and by 40 she is completely unmarriageable. And so she says, I will go to the court of King Zhuan. And she goes up to the court, and she offers herself in marriage, and someone at the door says, oh, I've got to tell the king about this, and brings her in. And she says, I would like to offer myself in marriage to you, King Zhuan. And he says, really? And then she turns invisible. And he says, oh, 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 oh. And then he says, according to one source, bring me all the books about turning invisible. And so they bring him all the books about turning invisible, and he reads them all, and he can't figure out how she did it. And so she comes back the next day, and he says, turn invisible again. And she says, I'm not going to turn invisible because it's too dangerous. And he says, what do you mean it's too dangerous? We're here in my palace. What could be dangerous? And she says, I'm glad you asked. Here are the four dangers. First, Kin and Chu are outside and corruption is inside. That seems bad. Also, you're showing off your wealth with this giant five-story palace while outside the people are starving and perhaps will be mad at you. Also, you're listening only to flatterers and persecuting people who speak honestly. That's no way to run a railroad. Finally, you're a drunk and a sot and you spend all your time in your harem and therefore you don't govern the kingdom. Those are the four dangers. Boom. And King Xuan says, well, those sound terrible. You're right. Which is the perhaps most legendary part of this whole story.
Yes. And separately, they would just be like insults. But if you package them together into the four dangers, it all sounds very official and convincing.
Right. And you can also turn invisible. And so he says, but seriously, turn invisible again. And I assume she does. But he appoints her the queen. He does keep his favorite concubine, Zhe Yingchun. So, you know, he's not quite giving up his licentiousness. But he also straightens up the state. He reinforces the walls. He reinforces the army. He fires all the flatterers and corrupt guys and sets up anyone can come to the kingdom and petition, you know, policy, which is very good. And possibly as a result of Zhong Lichun's reforms, he is the last state to fall to Qin in 222 BC. Also possibly it is the state farthest away from Qin. So who can say? And then interestingly, and this is, you know, I don't necessarily know how much score settling there is in Chinese historiography, but Mencius, the great disciple of Confucius, or Mengzi, as he is called now, was teaching in Qi basically all the way up until the period where she turns 40. He resigns in 312 BC. He says, it is impossible using Confucian teaching to affect change in the kingdom of Qi. I quit. This is dumb. And then, of course, a legendarily ugly woman who can turn invisible affects all the changes that Mencius would have wanted to affect. So I feel like maybe there's a little Taoist point scoring off the Confucians in this story. But it's a wild coincidence that, you know, he quits and then she shows up and everything that he's been recommending for 30 years becomes the law.
So she's the subject of a whole bunch of different Chinese language TV series and some movies. They're kind of obscure. I haven't been able to track them down. One of the TV series transposes her to the modern era, which sounds fun. So this is definitely a thing that you can borrow for different settings. Or if you want to do a campaign set during the Warring States era, that's all of the plot hooks you'll ever possibly need. But you can also have an advisor who is both blunt and plain, to say the least, and can turn invisible. She can show up in all sorts of different fantasy kingdoms and give what for to the king. And perhaps among the reforms she will suggest is that the trustworthy player characters, who surely have established themselves as such, be put in charge instead of all of the corrupt officials who are just looting the treasury and not defending it, the kingdom.
Yeah, or if you are trying to undermine Qi because you are serving Qin or one of the other states, or undermining the kingdom that has the legendary Invisible Observer, she can become sort of the person you have to take out in order to win. And she's, you know, both wise and can turn invisible. And it, I think, works best if she's so invisible that even someone who's read every book on turning invisible can't figure out how she does it, so that she always has that go-to power, that it's just as unstoppable as, you know, a regular superpower is, that you can't, you know, wire around it with detect invisible or something. You have to really think it out.
Well, since she can turn invisible, there's a possibility that she will follow us through this commercial message to whatever hut or segment awaits on the other side. So, Ken, let's watch our P's and Q's.
Right, away from the four dangers.
caught in the spiral.
Four scenarios embrace the works and deaths of agents between 2016 and 2020, years called the Spiral and the Delta Green Campaign, God's Teeth.
That span of cruelty and corruption in American government seemed a bitter interregnum.
A momentary eruption of spite.
Now it stands revealed as a preparation for revelations to come.
In God's eye, a baffling disappearance leads the agents to confront the inexorable government panopticon.
They face unnatural revelations unleashed by the death of privacy.
And must survive desperate revenge beneath the sleepless skies.
In God's breath, a Delta Green friendly leaves a frantic voicemail about a Denver prisoner vomiting up an alien worm.
Your agents must identify the unnatural threat.
Trace it to its source.
Burn it out.
Just be careful of the smoke.
In God's law, a shockingly gruesome death leads the agents to a Los Angeles police gang.
It has twisted older, deeper laws towards the tired avarice of corruption.
How far do the agents go to resist the unnatural?
In God's light, the wreckage left by a mass shooter catches Delta Green's attention.
Somehow behind it, a surprising app that reaches strange places on the border between worlds.
The scenarios of God's Hunt are playable with Arc Dream Publishing's Delta Green, the role-playing game.
Play the scenarios on their own, as a cycle, or as a perfect companion to the acclaimed campaign Delta Green, God's Teeth.
Learn more about Delta Green at delta-green.com.
Yea, verily and anon, join the esteemed company of such roistering Patreon backers as
Dan O'Hanlon,
Eric Parks,
Eric Lauren,
Evan Hughes,
and Ian Nystrom. Ken and I, you and I are both writers, and among the tools of the writer's trade, such as perhaps bourbon or coffee with bourbon in it, is the word, these very small units of meaning that we manipulate, put together, arrange into paragraphs. And that means that we're occasionally wont to enter the word hut. And this time around, as is typical for the word hut, I'm going to pretend to sort of quiz you on something. And this is an even harder one than ever. So it's not really a quiz, but it's a fun format to go through and explore the particular issue of where words first began to appear in the lexicon in English. So this game, Ken, is called Shakespeare, Johnson, or Marlowe. So I'm going to list words.
That's the Kiss, Marry, Avoid of Elizabethan drama.
Yes, exactly. But one thing that all three of them didn't avoid was using words, perhaps coining them, or perhaps just simply putting them in print for the first attestable time. So we're not arguing that they invented all of these words, because in a lot of cases, you can tell from context that the audience would have understood what was being said. In other cases, I think we kind of think they kind of did invent some of those words. So we're going to go through the list. And Ken, so I'm going to give you a word that is still a common word today. Sometimes, perhaps even one that might surprise us to think that it goes back that far. And you're going to guess whether it is Shakespeare, Marlowe, or Johnson. And yes, this is an essentially impossible quiz. So if you get more than random chance, you get many thousands of points. So the first one, Ken, is addiction. Was that Shakespeare, Marlowe, or Johnson?
Lifestyle, it ought to be Marlowe. But I'm going to guess Johnson. It just sounds Johnsonian to me.
In fact, it is Shakespeare. Ooh. From Henry V, the quote being, "Since his addiction to courses vain." So it suggested a compulsion.
Mm-hmm.
Astute listeners such as Ken will note that I'm doing these in alphabetical order to make sure they're all mixed up properly. The next one is amazement. Was that Shakespeare, Marlowe, or Johnson?
I know that it appears in Shakespeare, but just to throw it off, I'm going to guess Marlowe. That maybe Shakespeare got it from Marlowe.
Oh, you've out-clevered yourself, oh. Ken, because it appears for the first time in The Tempest, where Prospero is calming Miranda, saying, "Be collected, no more amazement. Tell your piteous heart there's no harm done." On a similar note, bedazzled. Shakespeare, Marlowe, or Johnson?
Bedazzled. I'm going to say, well, you know, as you say, it's alphabetic, so it is random. I'm going to guess Shakespeare again. I think that's a Shakespeare word.
You are correct.
Boom.
It's originally found in Taming of the Shrew. Pardon, old father, my mistaking eyes that have been so bedazzled with the sun.
Hurrah.
Okay, next we come to Birthplace, which was the first of these Elizabethan dramatists to get Birthplace.
Birthplace. I'm going to say Johnson. He's the king of backstory.
Once again, alphabetical order is confusing thing is best because it's still in Shakespeare Town.
Wow.
With Coriolanus, who says, "My birthplace hate I, and my love's upon this enemy town."
It's a harsh thing to say about Rome, even for a Roman.
Well, he was mad about a bunch of stuff.
Yeah, he had stuff going on.
Now, here's a real word that you and I use a lot in role-playing writing, and who would have thunk that it was first put in print in the Elizabethan era? Bloodstained.
Bloodstained.
Shakespeare, Marlowe, or Jonson.
Oh, please be Marlowe. Please be Marlowe.
Ding, ding, ding. You're right.
Yes.
This is from Edward II. Or what bloodstained ghost, what wrathful spirit would not be moved with Edward's piteous plaint? So not only does he get bloodstained into print the first time, but in reference to a ghost, what could be better?
That's my man. That's Christopher. Kit, as I call him.
Yes, good old Kit. Now we come to one that's a bit of a surprise that it goes back this far. Brainchild.
Brainchild.
Shakespeare, Marlowe, or Jonson?
Oh, man. I feel like that's a Shakespeare. I feel like that is the sort of thing that Shakespeare liked to do. Take two things that don't make any sense together and then somehow blend them perfectly.
Actually, this is the first time Jonson has shown up on our list.
There we go.
And it's from the Poetaster, which is the satire of a terrible poet. And the character is referring to a poem he's written. How do you like this? My brainchild, meaning the poem that he's written. Next, we come to efface.
Efface.
Who's the first one to get efface into the written published word?
I'm gonna guess Shakespeare, basically just on a sheer lark. That's what I'm guessing.
It is the larkiest of the three. It's Jonson, once again, from Bartholomew Fair. And this is there's a puppet show, and the puppet master then says, "I will not efface the memory of your zeal with this unseasoned laughter."
Oh.
Now, here's a word you think would have appeared way earlier than that. Maybe you would think that the Venerable Bede would mention this, but it's one of these dramatists who first got the word eyeball into print.
Eyeball. Oh, my goodness.
Eyeball.
Eyeball. Well, once more, if something is gross, fun, or exciting, I'm going to guess Marlowe.
Once again, Shakespeare gets on in. With the tempest, be subject to no sight but thine and mine, invisible to every eyeball else.
Mm.
Now, another word that is still very current, fashionable, first appears in one of these works of Elizabethan drama. Shakespeare, Marlowe, or Jonson?
Fashionable. Marlowe lived it, but Jonson cared about it, so I'm going to say Jonson.
It was Shakespeare, once again, in Troilus and Cressida. For time is like a fashionable host that slightly shakes his parting guests by the hand.
Mm.
Here's another word that you would think would go way back, and it's surprising that it is as late as the Elizabethan era. Gloomy.
Gloomy. Man, yeah. This is another one where I know Shakespeare uses it, and I'm not sure if it's in Marlowe. So I'm going to say Shakespeare.
Indeed, this is a trick question, because they both used it, but Marlowe got into print slightly earlier in Edward II.
Oh.
So he gets credit for gloomy in Edward II. The cause that makes him sit so gloomy. Here's another very still modern-sounding term. Hoodwink.
Hoodwinked. Oh, man. That's what I might even have read in the OG, which implies that it's either Shakespeare or Marlowe, because I've read very little Jonson. I'm going to say Shakespeare, though, because he's the rural boy. He's the country boy of the three.
It is Marlowe, and once again, Edward II.
Doe.
Let me alone. Here's the device to hoodwink him, and with fair words persuade him, which is Isabella scheming against Edward with Mortimer. Here's a kind of quotidian word that was first put into place by Shakespeare, Marlowe, or Jonson, and it's keystone.
Keystone. I'm going to say Shakespeare.
It is Jonson.
Ah!
In the Mask of Blackness, the keystone to a glorious pile.
There we are.
Well, it's time for a comeback as we get to the middle of the alphabet with lackluster.
Lackluster. Lackluster is, I'm sticking with Shakespeare. I'm sticking with Bill, my buddy.
You got it.
Yep.
It is Shakespeare. And As You Like It, Jacques describes a sad fool he sees in the forest. And then he drew a dial from his poke and looking on it with lackluster eye, says very wisely, it is 10 o'clock.
Who among us, etc.
Exactly. Here's a kind of everyday word, but somebody had to put it in print first. And it was Shakespeare, Jonson, or Marlowe. Manager.
Manager. Oh my God. Again, talking about fashionable, Shakespeare lived it. Jonson cared about it. I'm going to say Jonson.
It was Shakespeare in Midsummer Night's Dream. Theseus calls for his jester by saying, where is our usual manager of mirth?
Mm.
Here's another very everyday word, naughty. Who first put naughty into print?
Naughty. Well, I'm going to say if it isn't Kit Marlowe, it should be Kit Marlowe. So I'm saying Kit Marlowe.
It is Kit Marlowe in The Jew of Malta, where someone exclaims, oh, naughty, naughty world.
Yeah. There we go.
Now we come to a word that sums up this podcast. Nonsense. Who got nonsense into print first?
Shakespeare. Shakespeare did it. It's our Shakespeare boy.
It was Johnson in Every Man in His Humor.
Boo.
If your worship will have the patience but to hear the humors of the person, he hath materials in him to make a whole book of nonsense.
No, nonsense was in Cardenio, but it's lost now. That's what I say.
Now, there's a bit of a twist to this one. Playwright.
Playwright. Oh, man. Now, that is fun. Well, again, if this is one, if it isn't Marlowe, it should be Marlowe. So I'm saying Marlowe.
It's Johnson. The twist being that it's a term that he popularized outside of his actual work, but he meant it sarcastically.
Ah.
As in, oh, you think you're all so special. Oh, you're playwrights, right? Because you think you're building a ship. But then it has become the serious regular term for playwrights who take that term quite seriously, as if they're building ships.
If I'd known that it was meant to be condescending, it would have been easier to guess Johnson.
Well, you can take that up with the judges.
Oh, you're not a poet. You're an artisan. I get it.
Yeah, exactly. Here's another very everyday word, scuffle.
Ooh, scuffle. Well, again, Marlowe lived it, so let's say it's a Marlowe word.
You're correct. It is once again from Edward II. The desperate Mortimer secured for me in scuffle with the guard leapt o'er the walls and so escaped. This brings us to a very contemporary word. It's part of slang. Even now, it's come back. Swagger. Who first mentioned swagger?
Oh, my God. Who mentioned swagger? Again, Marlowe had it, but I'm going to say Shakespeare is the first guy to mention it because he's got so many characters that he needs to talk about.
Indeed. And the characters he's talking about in this case are rustics in Midsummer Night's Dream, where someone asks, what hempen homespuns have we swaggering here?
Mm.
So this brings us to another word you hear more about this decade than you have for several decades, making a comeback, uncomfortable.
Uncomfortable.
Uncomfortable is Elizabethan.
Is Elizabethan. Well, there we go. They needed a word for all the chairs that they were making. I would say uncomfortable. That could be a Shakespeare, because a lot of the Shakespeares are taking words that had already existed, in this case, comfort, and sort of twisting them around to fit into the slot. But uncomfortable sounds like it also might be a Johnson. So I'm going to say Shakespeare, but I'm going to feel right if the answer is Johnson.
Well, I'm glad you stuck with your first thought, because it's from Romeo and Juliet.
Yay.
Uncomfortable time. How, why camp'st thou now to murder our solemnity? Penultimately, we come to another word that you and I have to depend on a lot. Unearthly.
Unearthly. Unearthly. Oh my God. This is another one where I'm pretty sure Shakespeare uses it, but feel like Marlowe might have got in on it first, so I'm going to say Marlowe.
Oh, you unthunk yourself yet again. It's in The Winter's Tale.
I'm too devious for my own good.
Yes, it's Shakespeare. Oh, the sacrifice, how ceremonious, solemn and earthly. It was, 'twas e the offering, and that's character Dion describing the Oracle at Delphi.
Yeah.
And then finally, we come to unmoved. Is that Shakespeare, Marlowe, or Johnson?
Well, I'm just going to play the numbers here. Most of them have been Shakespeare, so I'm going to say Shakespeare.
There was a time to do that statistically and just say Shakespeare to everything, and you would have cheated your way to a win. But sadly, or perhaps not sadly, because it means you didn't crack the game, this is Marlowe from Dr. Faustus.
Ah.
Let him be new baptized. Let him be unmoved. So this means that you got 31% right, which is basically random chance with three people.
Too bad.
Yeah. So if you'd seen that the list was unbalanced, you would have noticed that there's, you know, just statistically, because Shakespeare wrote many more plays, he had many more opportunities to introduce words into the lexicon, or at least to get credit for them. Because again, in a bunch of these cases, presumably the audience wouldn't have just been going, uncomfortable, what's that mean? Which of course is my Elizabethan accent.
Yes, it's shockingly evocative. I felt I was at the bear pit.
It is, yeah.
Just sitting here.
Yeah, it's a Wessex accent, basically. Well, on that note, it's time for us to continue speaking words, but not in the word hut, in this upcoming hut and or segment. December 5th, 1775. A wagon train led by bookseller-turned-artillery officer Henry Knox arrives at Fort Ticonderoga in upstate New York.
His goal, haul captured British cannons through the snowy mountains to the siege of Boston and drive the redcoats from the cradle of liberty.
This year, Henry Knox's noble train of artillery delivers presents not to General Washington, but to you!
In Flag Bearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Visit nationsandcannons.com and use promo code CANNON at checkout for 17.75% off and free PDFs of your books. The whirring of time gears and the clacking of chronotons tell us that we're standing in proximity to Ken's time machine. This, of course, is the conveyance that his superiors at Time Incorporated used to send him back into history to bend, fold, spindle, and sometimes, yes, even mutilate it. And this time around, they have a question about what you could do to most change the timeline in respect to James Douglas, also known as Morton the Regent, Morton being his noble title. Which of James Douglas's murders, if prevented, would have the biggest effect on the timeline? You can adduce from this that this is someone who committed many murders or possibly was realistically accused of at least one of them, but maybe didn't commit them. So, Ken, put James Douglas, first of all, in his historical context that made him need to commit a number of political murders.
Well, his historical context is in 16th century Scotland, which, if you know anything at all about it, you know is a savage game of knife fight in a closet, played with religion, played with politics, and played with people who are rapidly recognizing that their mean neighbor to the south is richer and stronger than them in every way. So not a good look, but James Douglas was born in 1516. He's the son of the Master of Angus. I guess the equivalent would be a baron, Sir George Douglas. Before 1543, he has married his cousin, maybe Elizabeth Morton. She's the daughter of James Douglas, 3rd Earl of Morton. So he's in that, what they call the Red Douglas line. In 1548, he is captured by the English, defending his castle of Dalkeith during the Rough Wooing War, a war that the English launched to make the infant Mary, Queen of Scots, agree to marry the infant son Edward of Henry VIII. And that war keeps him captured until 1550, when he is returned to Scotland by the peace treaty. In 1553, his father-in-law dies and he becomes the 4th Earl of Morton. And in 1560, he invites the English to invade Scotland again, this time to evict the French, who are still sticking around in Scotland, having allied with them against the English, and to depose, coincidentally, the Catholic Queen Mary of Guise, who is opposed to the Morton family because the Mortons are Protestant. They evict the French, and Mary of Guise dies. So Mary, Queen of Scots, becomes queen, and for such services, he is appointed Lord Chancellor of Scotland in 1563. In 1566, he repays his liege by seizing her castle at Holyrood and killing her secretary, David Rizzio. Mary, Queen of Scots, at this point is 6 months pregnant with the future James VI. And David Rizzio is her private secretary. He's a former Italian dancing master and violin player and is, according to contemporary rumor, at the very least, involved in a throuple with Mary and her husband, Henry Stuart, Lord Darnley. In other cases, he's just the lover who gets in between them. And Darnley is argued to be part of the guy who gives over the keys to Holyrood and says, David Rizzio will be right up there in the upstairs bedroom. Go get him. They capture everybody. The queen escapes, reconciles with Darnley. Morton flees to England ahead of a charge of treason. But the Privy Council, which is all Protestant nobles, pardons him. So he comes back just in time to be part of the conspiracy to murder Lord Darnley. Darnley having now reconciled with Mary, he becomes a threat to Queen Elizabeth. There is a question as to whether Morton is working for Queen Elizabeth at this time, because Darnley is 3rd in line to the Scottish throne and something like 6th or 7th in line of the English throne, depending on how you count it. Queen Elizabeth does not want those two people united. So as a result of all manner of interest, because Darnley is also pro-Catholic, he is strangled and the house he's staying in is blown up. And the guy that is fingered for it is the Earl of Bothwell. And Morton, even at the time, is rumored to be the guy who sort of pushed Bothwell into doing it. Bothwell is acquitted of trial because he demands an immediate trial before anyone can gather any evidence. but four of his servants.
That's a nice trick if you can pull it.
Yep. Four of his servants, a royal page, and a random passerby who knew Bothwell, but Bothwell was famous, named William Blackadder, were all convicted and executed for the crime. One of Bothwell's servants under torture before being executed allegedly reveals the casket letters to Morton. And these are letters kept in a silver casket that contain proof of Mary and Bothwell's involvement in the murder of Darnley, as well as other, you know, secret marriage contracts and other things that were very scandalous and illegal at the time. So Bothwell then marries Mary. Everyone's like, really? You're going to marry the guy who just killed your husband? Even for a Catholic, that's bad. Sets off another round of rebellions. Morton, maybe using the casket letters, pressures Mary into abdicating in favor of the infant James VI. They put her in prison on an island run by Morton's cousin, William Douglas. And so, of course, in 1568, William's brother George helps her escape to England. At that point, she becomes Queen Elizabeth's problem, which is at least an improvement from Morton's perspective, I suppose. In 1572, Morton finally becomes regent of Scotland, the other two regents having died in probably non-murderous ways. He ends the Civil War by reconciling with most of the Catholic nobles and by taking Edinburgh Castle from Mary's last supporters in Scotland, and that pretty much puts paid to the Catholic interest at the time. They do not take this lying down. Their head, John Stuart, the fourth Earl of Athol, leads a faction to depose him as regent. Regents always making enemies. But his faction then forces a new Privy Council and elects him president of the Privy Council. So basically he's still the regent, even though he's not officially the regent. The trouble with being the regent to the infant James VI is James VI gets resentful at you regenting him. Once he enters his majority in 1579, he makes Athol his Lord Chancellor. And we are just about to see, you know, maybe some property being seized, maybe Morton getting in trouble, until Athol just suddenly dies of poison on the 20th of April, right after being Lord Chancellor. Weird. On March 15th, 1580, Morton's friend George Auchinleck admits under torture that Morton had had Athol poisoned on December 31st. They can arrest Morton and accuse him not of poisoning Athol, but of murdering Darnley. And he's arrested by Lord Lennox, who's Darnley's father, who has been biding his time this whole time. He's the guy who wasn't allowed to bring evidence to the trial because he didn't have any. So he just waits, has his own trial. 1581, Morton admits to foreknowledge of Bothwell's murder plot, but denies art or part of the deed, which I like. That's a good turn of phrase. It does not cut any ice with Lord Lennox, and he is executed on June 2nd, 1581, ending a entirely standard, as far as I can tell, career for a Scottish noble. Just betraying everyone, serving the English when you want to, betraying the English when you want to.
Being betrayed in kind.
Helping Catholics, even though you're a Protestant. Helping Protestants, even though you're a Catholic. It's just a game of, you know, mumble-de-peg with real knives is what's going on in this.
Right. So is your thesis here that the three definite and or likely murders, that's just par for the course among someone in his position?
I mean, it's still impressive, and he did not directly commit any of them, as far as we know, but he is definitely part of the conspiracy that lets the guys in to murder Rizzio. Later he says, I had no idea they were going to murder Rizzio. I thought they were just going to give him a stern talking to and tell him to stay away from the queen. I'm as shocked as you that he was stabbed 57 times in a building my men controlled.
Right, and with Darnley it would be, I would have strangled him or blown him up, but I wouldn't have strangled him and blown him up.
Right. And anyway, it was Bothwell that did it. And sure, Bothwell told me, but Bothwell told everybody. You can't execute a guy for listening to Earl of Bothwell. And then the Earl of Athol just suddenly dies of poison. Oops. I don't know that as many of them died of poison. One of them was literally shot in a gunfight, which is another. That's what happened to the Lord Protector bar one before him. So that's pretty great. Yeah, it's just, there's a lot of murdering going on. The Lord Darnley one is very famous because it's still technically unsolved. People don't like the obvious answer.
Yes, Time Incorporated thought they were asking you to choose between two murders, not three.
Right, yeah.
So let's get to that part. So specifying that the dossier is using the word murder loosely, it might mean that they were winking at murder or you commanded a murder. But let's call all of these three. Uh-huh. Which of these, if you unmurdered the situation, would change history, not necessarily for the betterest, but for the mostest?
Well, David Rizzio is, at the end of the day, just an Italian fancy boy. And him surviving just introduces strains into the Darnley Mary Rizzio thruple, but it does not necessarily change history. He's never going to be any more influential than private secretary to Mary, Queen of Scots. He doesn't have any politics except let's get Rizzio's beak wet. That's all he wants to do. So his murdering or unmurdering, it's a wash. Earl of Athol, as I hope I have indicated, is one of the indistinguishable murder-us-slash-murder-ed Scottish nobles of this era. The Catholic faction did not depend on the Earl of Athol, as you could tell by the fact that Lord Lennox was able to step up and get everything that the Earl of Athol would have ever dreamed of getting done, done, just faster and with dramatic irony. So Earl of Athol, I think, is another, you know, basically historically nugatory figure. Lord Darnley is the guy you've got to watch, because if he survives, not the king, he is the prince consort or the royal consort of Scotland, has a claim to the throne of England. And this, at the very least, will produce lots more English either wars with Scotland or attempts to suborn various murderous Scottish nobles into trying to kill Darnley. And the thing is, once you've started down the road of explosive conspiracy, you can certainly imagine a world where they take out Mary, Queen of Scots, and maybe even baby James the Sixth. And if they take out James the Sixth, then we don't get the Stuarts. We don't get the entire rest of the British royal family. We have to have Mary give it over to maybe one of the Percys or maybe one of the other heir families. And she has to sort of make a decision about it. So all of royal history changes if in an attempt to murder Darnley, they kill James. Elizabeth, by the way, did not want James killed. She was very mad at the murder of Darnley because it endangered James. There was a propaganda cartoon with little baby James drawn. This is like sort of would appear in broadsheets describing the murder, and they draw the building where Darnley was blown up and strangled. And then little baby James is sitting there saying, "Avenge this wound." So it was very clear that Elizabeth did not want James dead, but these guys, you know, these are the gang the original gang who couldn't shoot straight. Even if James survives and Darnley survives, we still have a lot of ruction on the northern border that after early in her reign, Elizabeth was able to avoid. Once James was titularly the King of Scotland, she was all right with letting that continue. And in fact, was trying through Morton to keep Scotland shut up and quiet. It's just that that is an impossible task. But with Darnley in charge, who, by the way, got along with nobody at all, there would always be ructions and problems. And maybe, you know, the Spanish Armada lands in Scotland if Darnley is still alive in 1588, which would be a bad situation all the way around.
So, in other words, Time Incorporated has to protect the strangling and or blowing up of Lord Darnley.
Well, if Time Incorporated is fond of the course of English history for at least the next 150, 200 years, yes, Lord Darnley, as they say, must die.
Well, this, I think, offers up a platform for gaming of treachery and conspiracy that is full of moment and stuff going on. It's a little touched part of history because Scotland is the history is nowhere nearly as well known outside of Scotland as yes, English history is.
It is known deeply in Scotland.
Yes. So you've got enough treachery and betrayal and shifting of sides and conflicts to power, you know, three vampire LARPs.
Yep.
You could possibly just sort of take all of these events and kind of reskin them into a vampire conspiracy.
And you say vampire LARPs, one of the people who did kill Rizzio, like in the room with a knife, was the Earl of Riven, who, of course, Lord Riven from The Vampire is his descendant, ? So maybe it is a vampire conspiracy to murder David Rizzio and drink his sweet Italian blood.
Well, let it never be said, people, that Ken doesn't save a nugget for the end of the episode.
Right.
So having reached the vampiric nugget, let us declare the end of this episode over, but we'll be back with another one a mere week from today. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Pelgrain Press.
Arc Dream.
Flagbearer Games.
Dark Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/KenAndRobin.
Protect this podcast from perfidious regents. by joining such backers as
Robert Dean,
Brian K. Eason,
Joshua Randall,
Yuri Horniman,
and Kelly Fisher.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken and Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Celebrate your joy of missing out with our latest design, Jomo.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindlaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when once again, we will talk about stuff.